Before we start today's episode, we wanted to let you know about an exciting giveaway happening now through September 19th. You can win two free VIP tickets for the Church National Conference, September 24th through 25th in Kansas City, Missouri at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. Hear about the mission of the church from powerful speakers like Jason K. Allen, Russell Moore, Owen Strawn, Jared C. Wilson, and others. Regular admission is $110 per ticket, but you can go for free. How? To enter the competition, go to missionspodcast.com/giveaway for instructions or follow the link in the show notes. But don't wait. See you in Kansas City and enjoy today's episode of the show. Welcome to the Missions Podcast, the show that explores your hard questions on missions, theology, and practice to help goers think and thinkers go. I'm Alex Kochman, here as always with Scott Dunford, one of our VPs here. And today we are joined by another one of our vice presidents here on our senior leadership team at ABWE. We have John Taylor, vice president of training and resources. John and his wife Jackie were appointed as missionaries by ABWE Canada in 1991, moved to Odessa, Ukraine, served there for more than two decades. They were on the leadership team for two different church plants. They served as team leaders and mentored Ukrainian church planters and pastors. And John, you were also the co-founder of the Church Ministries Institute in Eurasia and served for many years as its president. And now you're here at ABWE, and John holds graduate degrees in missions, theology, and education. And he's passionate about training our missionaries to do ministry well on the field. John, I'm so glad to have you on. We talk missions here. We talk theology here. We talk missiology, and it can be hard for practitioners to think and slow down and think through why they do things the way that they do them. So you're the perfect person to have here. Tell us a little more about yourself.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's good to be here. My family came from Canada, as you mentioned. We have three children, and we were appointed in 91 at that time to the Soviet Union. That was just that time of the world where everything was opening up in the eastern part of Europe. And so we had the incredible opportunity to be able to leave right at the beginning of the opening of the Soviet Union. And so by the time we arrived with our family in 93 to Odessa, Ukraine, at that point, the churches had established freedom and had established some priorities to plant churches. And so it was just a great blessing to be there right at that special moment in history that God had prepared for his church.
So what was the economic environment like that you were heading into? We're going to talk about money and missions in a second, but I think your background and what you went into coming from, you know, the vast wealth of Canada, as much as a ministry home
could be. Our neighbor to the north.
So what were you walking into? What was Ukraine like at that moment in history?
Yeah, I would say we didn't really expect that finances would be such an issue in our ministry, both in terms of potential conflicts and just the amount of time that we spent dealing with issues related to money, particularly as it relates to national ministries and support for national partners. So that kind of caught us by surprise. But when we first got to Ukraine in the early 90s, they basically were in a situation where the economy had collapsed, and the average income for a Ukrainian at the time we arrived was about $50 a month.
Wow.
Which is pretty consistent. We read in the research, and you've all heard the statistics, that half of the world today lives on less than $2 a month. And when I hear that, I think of remote jungle outposts or someplace in Africa. But as I reflect back to our time arriving in Ukraine, that was actually Ukrainians who were living on less than $2 a month.
So that, you know, you go to churches, and common missions, you know, tug on people's hearts is, we've got so much here in USA and Canada, or really even in the West. And then, you know, you're compelled to like look at the poverty and the challenges of places overseas that don't have as much. And like the first response is pull out your wallet and start giving. Mm-hmm. And yet, as you've started studying this and researching this, there's some problems that come along with ministry and money. Could you kind of walk us through what are some of those potential landmines that missionaries need to be cognizant of?
Yeah, definitely. I think we have this kind of ethnocentric perception that in the West that missionaries are not rich, that somehow we are poor. In fact, I read an article around the time that we were leaving for Ukraine that said that a certain percentage of children in Canada are being raised below the poverty line. Hmm. And I thought, this is terrible. In my own country, we have children being raised in poverty. And I went on to read in the article and actually defined what the poverty level was. And I realized they're writing about my children. Because as missionaries, we were actually below the poverty line in Canadian standards. And so you go to a place like Ukraine and you assume that we're going to be poor people. And then you arrive in Ukraine and all of a sudden they look at us like the Rockefellers with vast sums of money and wealth. And it was especially critical in the former Soviet Union, because they knew that the church in the West had been praying for over 70 years that freedom would come. And they were praying that someday the openness would come and they'd be able to come in and come alongside the church and help them. And so, you know, 93, and here come John and Jackie with their, at that time, two little babies. And we had all these boxes that we brought with us, and they assumed these must be filled with money. We know the church in the West is, you know, has millions and millions of dollars. And they thought, well, they've been praying and waiting for this moment. The moment's arrived. They're going to come with all their vast wealth and help us out. And basically, the boxes were our own things.
Yeah.
And so we made a lot of mistakes in the early days, looking back on it. Just that perception, really, it was something that we had not expected. And we ran into the poverty and realized just what that means. But the other interesting thing was that the church in Ukraine was doing well without finances. Mm-hmm. Obviously, finances we knew would help them. But they were doing a lot of things. They were very active, very involved in church planning and evangelism. And living within their means. And so as we came, we did try to help them financially, but realized as soon as we began those efforts, it actually did create conflict.
Yeah, well, so that's a topic that I think is coming to the fore in more and more people's minds. Books like Helping Without Hurting, Toxic Charity, it's becoming a bigger conversation of ways that people with the best of intentions can actually end up hurting nationals in some of these fields. And like you mentioned, it's not just the third world or developing countries. It's westernized countries, too. It's all over the world, anywhere where there's economic disparity. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the factors that go into why don't you just paint a picture of the problem for us? I know you have outlined about five different problems that we see as we get into the issue of money and missions. There's not just one problem. There's all these problems layered on top of each other. How do you see those things emerging?
Yeah, I would say the first factor that contributes to the conflict between missionaries and nationals as it relates to finances is simply the economic disparity that does exist. As you realize that many of our missionaries are going to that part of the world where people live on less than $2 a day, and those missionaries are bringing literally thousands of dollars in financial support for their own families and for their ministries. One author, Jonathan Bonk, kind of an interesting author, he called this the Achilles heel of missions in an EMQ article. This was back in the 80s. So this has been an issue that missionaries have been wrestling with for decades. And just the fact that there is that economic disparity, and that as a result, actually one of the most unfortunate consequences about this economic disparity for many missionaries is the failure to develop deep and meaningful relationships with nationals. And I would say that would be the second factor, that social isolation of missionaries from the nationals. And part of that is related to the disparity. It becomes very uncomfortable when you take your family to a McDonald's and realize that the national partners you're working with can't afford to go to McDonald's. Mm. So do you just, you know, pay for them and take them with you? And you just don't feel comfortable because it's your two worlds are colliding in one place. Mm. You have North America and then you're in Ukraine. And so every now and then missionaries feel like I like to just get away and be myself. Yeah. And so what they tend to do is just associate themselves with either their team of missionaries or with other expats in the country. And unknowingly over a period of time, they begin to create that social isolation from the nationals that they're going to serve, which is very unfortunate. But we experienced that at times. Every now and then we'd get away for a retreat as a team to a location where we knew none of our national partners would see us and we'd be able to go enjoy a time at a pool or something like that. But the whole time feeling that guilt. So that actually drives you to try to detach your life from your ministry and from your churches, and you want to just get away into that little bubble. Mm.
I felt this in a smaller way just when we were overseas, in that we didn't fit with the majority of the people who were very poor. We didn't fit with the elite who were very wealthy. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of in some kind of weird middle zone that didn't exist in that culture. Mm-hmm. And then even just our ways of dealing with you know, it'd be normal if someone has more wealth here that they just treat every time. Well, I can remember one really strong conversation I had with a friend who knew me well enough to speak plainly with me and said, "You buying all the time makes me feel like less of a man, because I can never repay, and my culture, I must repay that." And it was humbling for me, but also it highlighted this problem, which, you know, I think you're describing, but even more so when you're trying to do partnership together. This was in an evangelistic context. You're talking about partnership in ministry, and that creates a big problem. It's almost as if you're on a staff together and one pastor is making a lot and one's making a little. How do you work that out? So
yeah, absolutely. And I think many missionaries that serve in a country where there is that economic disparity, they sense that tension constantly. Our children used to listen to this song. It was from a Disney movie, The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And of course, the lead character is in this tower prison, and he sings this song where he says he would love to just spend one day among the ordinary people. I don't know if you remember that song. You can sing it for us, Alex, if you remember it. But there's this one line in there where he says, I would like to live not among them, but be one of them. And I think that's the tension that missionaries mm-hmm. often face, that we so desperately want to be one of the people that we're serving. We want to be not just among the Ukrainians, but we want to be a Ukrainian. We want to be one with them. We don't want to be treated differently. But then at the same time, because of the money and because of the fact that we represent the wealth of North America, that often drives a wedge, and we can't be one of them, no matter how hard we try. Mm.
There's also some cultural differences between the way money is treated. Scott alluded to some of those, you know, in an Asian context, that reciprocal giving is expected. Mm-hmm. You know, Ukraine isn't that far from Asia, technically. Is that right? Something that's a factor there and elsewhere too?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the recommendations that I give in my article at the end, is that to help the recipient from being dehumanized, from constantly being on the receiving end, it's good to look for ways that they can also give back in return. It's almost impossible, for example, in our context in Ukraine, to outgive a Ukrainian. So if you treat them to a meal in your home, then of course you'll get an invitation to go to their home, and they'll give the best that they have and give back. It's interesting. When we first came, that just overwhelmed us, and we thought, these people are so giving, they're so generous, and that's very it's just a real blessing to see that. But then after a period of years there, you begin to realize, oh wait, that's what they're expecting us to do. They gave everything that they had to us. They're expecting us to give everything we have back to them. Mm. The difference is, they may not have a lot to give, but they give it all. We had a lot to give. Are we willing to give everything that we have to them? So our children.
Preacher.
Yeah. So our kids would be in somebody's home, and we had to teach them, because they would say, oh, I like that toy. And so the children were trained, give that toy to that child, because he wants it. So you give it to them. So we had to coach our kids every time we went to someone's place, don't tell them you like anything. Right. It was so difficult for us to be receiving something that we knew they had paid a lot for, or that was valuable to them. But the difficult thing for many missionaries is that realization moment that really, if we are going to be one of them, they're expecting us. This, of course, of former communist society, very socialistic mentality and communal, they're expecting us to give everything. And are missionaries willing to give everything that they have? Mm.
So you talk a little bit in your article about how money can be used for manipulation too. Mm-hmm. Would you just go into that a little bit? How do we need to be careful as we use money to be certain that we're not manipulating? How do you even know when that's happening?
Sure. And there are two kinds of manipulation. There's intentional manipulation and unintentional. So intentional manipulation, we would call that paternalism. Mm. You know, we think back to the way that missions was done a century ago. And it was assumed by the early missionaries that whoever puts up most of the money should control the agenda and control the accountability for how that money is spent.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like some deacon boards.
Lots of ministry contexts that's true in. Yeah.
Just secular contexts. It's the power of the purse.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. And, you know, it could be argued that paternalism is less of a problem in modern missions because we've learned, we've gone beyond that colonial mentality. But there's still a tendency today for missionaries to manipulate the national church by their use of money in an unintentional way. And I can give some examples of that. Many national leaders are being supported by missionaries to cater to theologies and methodologies of those who support them. So they receive money and they feel that they need to somehow reciprocate by following the agenda of the person who gave the funds. If we decide to choose a national partner that we're going to support, if he doesn't agree with our agenda, then we're going to stop supporting him.
Right.
So what is a national leader going to do? They're going to cater and pander to what they think that we want him to do. And so we may not have been intending to manipulate him, but just by virtue of the fact that we have the choice of who we support, that becomes a form of manipulation.
You also talk a little bit, I have your article outlined here in my not formerly nicotine-stained fingers here, but you also talk a little bit about missionaries themselves and their giving. And you're probably referring there to not just the projects that missionaries are supporting and partnering with, but also, you know, when a missionary goes to the field, they also want to be generous and obey the biblical command to give. Even if they're living off of financial support, they're going to continue to tithe and to give offerings. And so, so what are the difficulties created by the missionary's own individual practice of generosity?
Right. It can actually cause several unintended problems. The first one, I think we've already talked about a little bit, is that dehumanization of the recipients. There was one Indian Christian spokesman by the name of R.C. Das. He wrote about his fear that by receiving funds, they would lose the dignity that comes with financial dependence. There is a sense of humiliation sometimes, and you guys have probably experienced that even in North American culture, where you receive an especially large personal gift from somebody. And there's a certain sense of humiliation that I feel badly that they did so much for me. Missionaries struggle with that when supporters give us things. We sometimes feel guilty even asking. And when they do give us things, somebody hands a wad of bills in your hand at the end of a service. I feel terrible about that. And I feel somehow I didn't earn that and I need to give something back to him. And so when they begin to feel dehumanized, and this is getting maybe the field of Christian psychology here a little bit, but they can actually resort to a number of coping mechanisms. One of those, they may try to escape that sense of humiliation by looking upon themselves as the benefactor. So in some twisted way, they just received a gift, and yet somehow they feel that they were doing you a favor by letting you give them whatever you gave them. Another way that they can respond is in gratitude, because if they say thank you, then that just reinforces that sense of humiliation. They may make threatening demands for even greater generosity, or even in some cases, we've seen where they feel they now have the right to take things in exchange and will resort to thievery. And we've certainly observed all of those things in our ministry. And it's very confusing for the giver to say, how could they somehow, in fact, I've even heard the phrase given, you need to thank us for the fact that we allowed you to invest in our ministry. And I thought, wait a minute, aren't we supposed to be the ones that are thanked for giving? And, and yet, as I realized and as I looked into this, is that dehumanization aspect that they're responding to that can cause great problems. A second one is inequality among nationals. The missionary not only decides who should receive the support from the West and humanitarian aid, they also decide who should be given a job with the mission, who are we going to employ, what produce do we buy, which vendor do we go to. So in all of those areas, we can unintentionally create inequality among nationals and create a conflict among the nationals between each other. And then the third area is that of dependency, of course, and this has been written about a lot. One author suggested that financial support from the West becomes like scaffolding in the construction of a new building. But in some cases, that scaffolding can't no longer be removed because it's become the structure that's holding the fragile building together. And often that's what our giving can do. It creates that scaffold, which becomes a permanent fixture of the building that it was supposed to support.
That's sobering. One of the things that I love about your approach and your ministry, though, John, is that you're not just a theorist, you're a practitioner, and you're here not just doing research, but also training and helping missionaries who are on the field to be better at some of these things. And so I know that you're thinking about not just the problems, but the solutions, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you have four solutions that you would say aren't the most wise.
Right.
And so walk us through what are some of the ways that we would attempt to deal with these things, but maybe some of the potential pitfalls of those as well.
Yeah, a lot of authors have come up with solutions for this conflict, this problem that exists. And so let's knock down the four first.
Let's
right
do
off
it.
The bat that I don't really think work on the field. They sound great. In print, but they don't actually work in practice.
This is where the controversy is coming in. So if you're going to write your hate mail, get ready for this section.
And I'll toss out some names just so we can start to throw darts. Mm-hmm. The first one is, it sounds really good. It's called the incarnational approach.
Oh, such a buzzword.
Yeah.
It makes me feel good just to hear it. Guys, let's be incarnational.
Oh, brother.
Now, one of the leading proponents of this is Jonathan Bonk.
Are you saying it's all a bunch of bunk?
Not bunk,
oh,
bunk.
Word. You guys would listen and think Alex is like 80 years old with all the puns, but I promise you, he's like 25. Yes, that's Alex.
I have the humor of an 80-year-old.
Okay, yeah, okay. Moving on. Or junior high teacher. Okay, so he believes that Jesus' lifestyle of total identification with the world is our model for cross-cultural missionaries that we need to follow. So in other words, Jesus grew up poor, he lived surrounded by the poor, and he died poor. And yet all of the means of the universe were at his disposal, but he chose not to use those. And so he would suggest that that's what missionaries should do. We should live poor, we should surround ourselves by the poor, we should die poor. Another key spokesman for this incarnational approach is Ron Sider, who talks about the need to live a simpler lifestyle. So that would be the first one, but many have begun to push back on that one. It sounds really good, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
To be
yeah.
humble, live.
Well, it's the Catholic vows of poverty, for the priests and.
But I even think Philippians too. You know, we do need to give up our rights. I mean, nobody's denying that,
right? Yeah. But the problem is that this incarnational lifestyle will never solve the problem of identification with the nationals that we're serving with, nor is even Christ's incarnation normative for missionaries living in poorer cultures. One author, Jim Pluteman, one of my mentors, he said the incarnation was never intended to give us a model for missionary strategy. One African missionary said that impoverished people are not looking for missionaries who imitate them, but rather they're looking for missionaries who will model for them ambition, resourcefulness, hope, a better way of life.
It also doesn't necessarily help the poor. You're not lifting other people up just by debasing yourself.
Right.
Right. It could be self-serving in a way.
Yeah.
Ironically.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were at a missions conference once, and one veteran ABWE missionary said to me, "You are not going to the mission field to live the life of the nationals. You're going to the mission field to do the work of the Lord." And, you know, we could have tried to live at exactly the lifestyle of the poorest person around us, and yet that would have compromised our ability to be involved in ministry.
Yeah.
We would never have been able to begin a Bible Institute. We would never have been able to function. We would be spending most of our time just trying to survive. And is that what our sending churches send us to do? So I'm not sure that that's the right answer, the incarnational method, although it sounds good. I'm all for a simpler lifestyle, but if we believe that that means we have to live exactly like the poorest people around us, I'm not sure that that's the best model for missions ministry.
I think you made a good point too. It also might be misappropriating just the incarnation itself as a doctrine.
Right.
Jesus was virgin born. That doesn't mean that we should all imitate that too.
Yeah.
You know,
just in my little experience, it creates confusion sometimes amongst nationals too. They're like, we know you're not Ukrainian. Mm-hmm. We know you're not Chinese. We know you come from America. Why are you faking that? I've had officials think that was strange, and they knew of an American living in that part of town, not in a good way, but in like a very suspicious way. Like that guy might be a criminal because he's doing things that only a criminal would do, you know? So it could create confusion. Like, where do you fit
right.
culturally?
And it's hard to strike that balance. I mean, you do want to try to live simpler. You don't want to flaunt. You don't want to live in excess.
Wartime lifestyle.
Right. And certainly our family, we lived in an apartment building, in a 12-story apartment building, just like everyone else. For most of our time there, we didn't have a car. We took public buses just like everyone else. We shopped at the same markets as everyone else. We tried to live as much as we could at the level of the Ukrainians. And yet at the same time, they knew fully well if one of us got sick, we had a health plan. And they would fly us to Vienna to get treated for, you know, surgery that was necessary or whatever. They knew we had a pension plan. Mm-hmm. So we had something to fall back on when we retired. They, you know, they knew that we had a plan to pay for our children's education. So they knew no matter how hard we tried, it never really helped. They still associated us with the affluent West, no matter how hard we tried. So I'm not sure that approach really solves any problem.
Well, sure. Why don't we just send money instead?
Well, there you go. So that would be the second one, the just send money approach. And
I hear this from a lot of pastors.
Yeah.
They're doing it better over there. Just send them all the money. Why? We can do it cheaper.
Oh, I've
probably heard some truth in that in some places. Otherwise, people wouldn't be saying it, perhaps.
Maybe. That's right. So stop sending missionaries. K.P. Yohannan, you know, Indian author and missiologist. This was his thesis. He said, keep the missionaries at home, save the money, and just send us the money instead. And we've heard that over and over. The amount of money that you guys spend on getting here and paying your missionaries, just send us the money and we'll do a better job with it than you will.
And anyone who's followed the saga of his organization has seen that going awry.
Right. We won't go that way, but it turns out it didn't necessarily work for them. But
sure.
But the problem is, even if the missionaries stay away from the field, the presence of foreign money, if we send that, will continue to foster conflict. It doesn't really solve the problem of money being creating unintentional manipulation, and all the other problems will still be there. In fact, one of the critiques of that is that the just send money approach can actually lead to abuses. Some supporters are unable to clearly discern if the national church situation far away on the other side of the world and across cultural barriers is actually accomplishing that which they intended. And so I think there is a responsibility with the money that we need to be accountable before God, to whom he has entrusted much. We are responsible for that. Right. I don't think we should just send a blank check and not really care how it's being used. And unless there's somebody on the ground to see how those funds are being distributed and how they're actually being used on the ground, I think we're being irresponsible. And so often the missionary on the field can be that person on the ground who is aware of the situation and can help to make sure that those resources are being used in the best way possible.
Even biblically, you know, there are times when you send money. The church at Antioch sent relief to the church in Jerusalem. But, you know, the problem today is exasperated by instant, you know, one-click giving, which didn't exist back then. They were sending it by the hands of Saul and Barnabas. They went there in person carrying this gift. They came back with a report of how the church in Jerusalem was doing. Mm-hmm. So there's relationship there that isn't always present in this just send money model.
Right. Right. And certainly we had some great national partners in Ukraine. And so I'm not speaking of the relationships that I was in. We had a high level of trust. And part of that was because we were there and we lived among them and were serving on teams with them. But I have seen many negative situations of churches in the West that just sent money to other organizations in Ukraine where it was used inappropriately and used to enrich church leaders, used to create problems. And it wasn't used in a way, although it may have been used by God to bless the church, it wasn't used in the way that the donor intended it to be used. Mm. So that's a just sending money approach. So we're going to knock down the third one.
Let's do it.
Okay. This one's called the indigenous approach. This was Glenn Schwartz suggested that Western churches and missionaries should just stop giving altogether. That would solve the problem, wouldn't it?
Great idea.
Yeah, I can see why some people would like that approach.
It would potentially create conflict as it relates to money, certainly. This was supported by McQuilkin. He published an article on Christianity Today back in 99 called Stop Sending Money and encouraged the church in the West just not to send any money. He said in the New Testament, there's no justification for supporting the ministry of other churches, but also there's great hazards in doing so. Now, I'm not quite sure where in the New Testament he got that principle.
Yeah.
But that was the argument that he was making. And this goes along with that three self view, the three self, meaning a church should be self-governing, self-propagating, and self-supporting, with the emphasis on the third one, the self-supporting. They should support themselves. And that movement became very popular in the 50s, as you know, and continued even to this day. But the problem with that is that this three self approach has left a poor, weak baby church that's struggling to exist side by side with a rich, powerful, mature mission organization.
In the name of handing it off to them prematurely.
Right. And so the whole policy of self-support can be somewhat idealistic, but it's my feeling is that as members of the global body of Christ, it's incumbent upon us as a church in the West to share our wealth with poor churches in other countries. With God, there are no borders as it relates to generosity. Mm-hmm. And I believe we are responsible to our brothers and sisters in Christ around the world. And so the true biblical model is not so much three self as it is interdependence. Mm-hmm. We are all interdependent among whether it be within our own borders or whether it be outside of our borders.
That does seem to be like there's that tension with Paul, you know, as Paul's, you know, one group is abounding and the other one is rich, or even just reminding them, you know, when the Council of Jerusalem, you know, sent out, just don't forget the churches here, you know, and that was, it seemed like a constant burden of Paul to make sure that the churches in poverty were being blessed. But we also, I also sympathize in some ways with the indigenous model in the sense of like, you know, we can just reproduce methods overseas that worked in America, but that won't work there because as soon as the funding runs out, it's impossible for that to work. So there is kind of a tension there, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we tend to think in our culture somewhat ethnocentrically, as you know, and it's all about, let's just say it, it's all about America first, that we need to care for ourselves first. Is that really a biblical model? Does God call upon us to seek justice only for the people that live within an arbitrary government border? Or is God called upon us to reach the world and to care for the world and for the impoverished in the world? And so sometimes I think we need to take our eyes off of ourselves and our own local churches. I'll tell you just one story, and this has been echoed many times, where churches have helped churches in Ukraine by sending them just a couple thousand dollars to help them with the church building. You know, the Ukrainians, they go online too. They have the internet and they can go on and they look up the church's website in America that gave that money, and they realize the millions of dollars that are being spent just to expand their foyer of the church and put in a coffee house.
Yeah.
And yet they know that they can only come up with maybe $2,000 to assist them with their own church building when they're meeting outside in the winter in the cold because they have no place to meet. So I wrestle with that. I have issues with that. So that's the third one. The fourth one approach that I believe isn't totally adequate, and this one may surprise you, but this would be the partnership approach, which again sounds great.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah. We need to join hands together and make joint decisions and do this all together with them as equal partners in the gospel. And this concept seems to be appealing, and yet in reality, the problem with this approach is that it's almost impossible to achieve. Because as you know, money gives power, power results in domination. And as long as one side brings more money into the equation than the other, you're going to have some form of control, even if it's unintentional. So as I mentioned before, if it becomes evident that the partner is heading in a different direction than the sponsor in terms of ministry philosophy or, say, doctrinal beliefs, then that Western partner still maintains the ability, and I would even argue the biblical responsibility, to withdraw its support. And so the knowledge of that from the national side will cause them to continue to pander to the desires of the Western partner. And so it sounds great, that partnership thing, but in reality, it rarely exists.
And we're probably blind to that, too, as the Westerner's going.
Right.
We're probably blind to see that influence that's happening there. We might be saying all the right things about equal partnership and equal way in, But Scott, it looks like you wanted to weigh into
your... Yeah, I was thinking of all sorts of examples where that we know that's true. It's true like in an employee-employer relationship where two employees will relate to each other one way, but then they'll relate differently to their boss because he controls their means of economic advancement. We know intuitively that that's true, and yet... It's hard for us to say, like, hey, this guy's my friend. Of course he's being honest with me, and I've worked with him, and we've partnered together, without realizing that there is leverage there that may cause him or her to question, you know, to hesitate before challenging an idea, because all they have to do is take their money and go another way, and now my means of support and survival. So you bring that up, but intuitively, if we think through that, you're like,
we can be naive.
We want to believe that there could be that equal partnership, but money does change the dynamic. There's just no way around it.
Right. I love the word partnership. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with viewing yourselves as an equal partner. Mm-hmm. And I certainly think in terms of our value before God, we are equal. There's no one person that's more valuable than another. And I would never place myself, in fact, usually I would put myself below our national partners in Ukraine. They have so much that they can teach me and so many gifts, and they know God's word. They're gifted. They're experienced far more than I am. And yet when you bring money into the equation, this is where we're talking about partnership as it relates to money, then it becomes very tricky. And
so you're not saying no partnership. You're just saying be recognizing the fact that even in an equal partnership, there is still a conflict.
Right. I'm all for partnerships, but that will not resolve the conflict about bringing money into the relationship.
So let's talk about some actual solutions to the conflict then. So the four solutions that are proposed and tossed around maybe aren't always that strong. The incarnational approach, the just send money approach, the indigenous approach, and a partnership approach. How can we actually address it though? What are some practical things that missionaries can do to avoid the pitfalls?
All right. Yeah, obviously all those approaches are fraught with difficulty, and there really is no solution that will completely eliminate the conflict. It will be there as it relates to money and
the poor you will always have with you.
Exactly. But I think there are still some steps that any missionary can take that will mitigate the potential risk, that will minimize the potential for conflict with nationals, and will help resolve the conflicts that will inevitably arise over money. So again, you know my belief, I believe grounded in God's word, that we must give. It's not an option for the body of Christ. We are commanded by God to give towards those who are less fortunate than ourselves. But what steps can we take to minimize the risk there? And I think there are some things we can do. As it relates to economic disparity, I do believe that we can live more humbly and simply on the mission field. Why create barriers that are not necessary? Do I need that beautiful home in an expensive part of the city when I could be living among the people? Is there a way that I can live a simpler lifestyle without compromising my ability to serve in ministry? And I think there are some things that we can do by living simpler lifestyles. Again, I quoted Jim Plutman before. He said, effectiveness in mission service probably has very little to do with affluence. And so ultimately, it's not about the level that we live at. He said, our Achilles heel is more likely to be the lack of love for the people that we work with. And I think that's even more important. We may not, no matter how we live, I think ultimately the most important thing, and this would be the second way that we can mitigate the potential dangers, is the importance of relationship, developing relationship with the people that we serve with. Recognizing that the majority of people in the world value relationships above most anything else and most other values. So are we willing to share our possessions with our neighbors? Are we going to immerse ourselves in the local culture? Are we going to assume a humble attitude in working with nationals? Are we willing to suffer? But also, to what degree are we developing friendships with nationals that we're serving with? Even if it will be somewhat superficial level at first. And again, we struggled with this because we obviously, it was obvious that we had more affluence than the people that we were living among. Yeah. And so we would try as hard as we could to develop relationships with them, knowing that it will never get beyond maybe that superficial or quasi-superficial level. It will never get to the deep level that they can relate with one another. But we could still develop some kind of a relationship with them. So what's our relationship with the people that we buy bread with at the store? Are we trying to develop relationships with them? you know, just the shopkeepers, the nationals, are we entertaining them in our homes? Are we hanging out together with them at the park? Are we doing things with them, with our families, getting to know them? Or are we just hanging out in our little missionary subcultural bubble and hanging out with the people that we can just let our hair down with? Are we willing to make ourselves uncomfortable and do things with the nationals? And that's something that we had to learn and work very hard, because it's not our natural presupposition as missionaries. So the importance of relationship, I think, can overcome a lot of the potential risks in this area. So that would be the second one. The third one, try to bridge the cultural gaps. Build a close relationship with a trusted national who will be able to help us in confusing situations when we don't understand how there's miscommunication when it comes to money. And then the final one is avoid manipulation. I think to avoid manipulation, how can we do that? First of all, I think we need to carefully identify national partners up front who already share the same goals that we have. Mm-hmm. Don't choose that in midstream and try to manipulate agendas, but maybe wait, survey the situation, look at the people around you, find out where is God working in the same way that we want to work.
And it almost, I would imagine part of that is you kind of holding some of your expectations close to the chest as you wait to hear the national partner articulate what their goals are,
right?
At which point you can come in and say, actually, yeah, we are on the same page or we're not, rather than you saying, here's what we want to see accomplished in Haiti, and they just parrot back something to you that's exactly what you want to hear.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you go meet with a pastor somewhere or a denominational leader. Your first question shouldn't be what to explain what you want to do in ministry. Wait and ask them to articulate their vision. Usually what they'll do is they'll say, why don't you tell me what you want to do? And then we'll do whatever you want to do. And so at that point,
which feeds our ego, right?
It does.
We want to be thought of as the experts.
Yeah. And we like to think that somehow we have greater strategies and wisdom than everybody else, which is not true at all.
We are American. Well, not everyone. Present company excluded.
Well, Canadians even better.
North American. Yeah. So just don't answer that question. Say, why don't you tell me first about what the burden that God's placed on your heart?
Yeah.
And don't even say what your agenda is coming into it. Just wait and look around and find people that already have the same passion, because that passion shouldn't change just because they receive some finances or the hope of finances. So that's one thing that you can do. And then finally, I think we can give wisely, learn how to give wisely. This would be advice to missionaries. What are some ways that I can give that will not dehumanize? And we've talked about some of those things already. Reciprocal giving. Giving in a way that they can give back to you in return. We had a missionary on the field. He really wanted to help one of the Ukrainians in his church who was struggling, who was without a job. And so the initial instinct is, let me just hand him some money.
Yeah.
But that would not have necessarily helped this individual. He would have felt humiliated. He would have felt like he owed something back. So instead what he did was, would you take my Bible? There's nobody that I know of in Ukraine. If you know out there anybody who's published a Bible in Russian with accent marks, if you would let me know, because I've never found one. And I always get the accents wrong when I speak Russian. And so did my teammate. And so he said to them, would you take my Bible and just mark all the accent marks so I know how to pronounce these words? And he went through the entire Bible and put all the accent marks in. And he says, I will pay you to do that because it will help me in my preaching to sound better and to make it sound more Russian.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was out of work anyways. He had the time and he knew how to read. Obviously, he was a native Russian speaker. So he felt like this was now a job. I wasn't just receiving something that I need to somehow give back. He was being given an opportunity to give back. But if you can't give someone a job, if they already have a job or if they're already busy, there are other ways to do that. For example, a sister church is supporting a sister church in Ukraine. Don't just ask the sister church in Ukraine for prayer requests. Send prayer requests from America and say, would you as a church pray for us? And send pictures and make it meaningful. Say, every week we will send you a list of two or three prayer requests. Would you become our prayer warriors and uphold us before the Lord in prayer? Mm-hmm. Ukrainians are great at that. And they
probably
will take it seriously.
Most Americans are.
Yeah, sure. They will pray and fast, and they will feel like we are doing something to bless the church back in North America rather than just always being the takers. They now become the givers. So there are some ways to get around that with reciprocal giving.
So you're not saying at all don't give. You're saying let's just be wise in how we're doing that.
Right. Yeah. Find ways to give that will not dehumanize, that will not hurt the ministry as best as you can.
One of the things that you also pointed out is utilizing national organizations mm-hmm. and channeling funds through that. What would that actually look like on the ground?
Yeah, it's very important that any money should go through a local accountability structure rather than going directly to the recipient. Mm. And that can be difficult. You see some cases and you want to just reach in your pocket and help out. And yet we constantly reminded ourselves as a team and tried to discipline ourselves, go through the local church, go to a pastor. Don't, you know, it maybe not as gratifying because you want to be able to, you want to say, oh, John gave me this and that. And you want other people to know that, but that's really the flesh speaking. Mm-hmm. Be willing to give anonymously and give through the local church. And let the pastor be the one to handle that.
Well, we know just in our own churches that there's times when the pastors are aware of a situation where, yeah, there's a need, but mm-hmm. the need has been met 100 times and there's another deeper yes. problem. We do that in our own churches. Why don't we think that that would be the wise thing to do overseas?
Right.
But you know, you see a lot of times churches are directly working with someone that they don't know that well. They don't know the culture. They don't know the language, but they've been there 3 or 4 times. I was just with an Indian pastor who's just shaking his head at how many American churches that go over there to India. A guy puts on a big show, hires a bunch of people to act like converts, and it's all a sham. And the Indians all know it. The Americans are the ones that are fooled, and mm-hmm. and it hurts everybody. It makes you not want to give when you know you've been fooled, but it also hurts legitimate ministries. And it's a really bad testimony amongst the Hindus who see that charade going on and think that's what Christianity is about. So mm-hmm. don't stop giving, but you're giving us some wise ways to proceed. Are there any other things you would add to that?
Yeah. Well, there have been times where I've gone to Ukrainian pastors and I say, you know, this guy, I believe, has a need. He's approached me. Could we help him? And they've said, actually, he doesn't have a need because we've already covered that as a church. Ah. He's just, you know, asking. And they say, but here's somebody else who has an even greater need.
Mm, yeah.
And so, you know, that very wise advice. So try to go through the local accountability. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that now you're just putting the Ukrainian church leaders and the elite in place of the missionary. So you're just passing the problem on to him, where now he's choosing where the resources are allocated. But
he's probably better equipped to deal with it
exactly.
than the missionary is.
Yeah. He understands the culture. He understands the people. He can navigate the politics of that better than I can as an outsider coming into his culture.
And you also talk about you want to conclude all of this by saying that you do want churches and organizations overseas to be financially independent. So you're not mm-hmm. you're not throwing out the idea of being self-sustaining financially, those three selves that you mentioned earlier. So what does right. fostering financial independence in a healthy way look like in the context of interdependence in the body of Christ?
Right. You want to focus on specific projects that are limited in their duration. So they have a time period. Say this project will last for 2 years or 5 years or 3 months or whatever it is, so that you know it's not going to be an expectation that will be long term. Mm-hmm. And also you want to focus on specific goals and be very specific and articulate what are the goals of this particular gift. This will be in order to accomplish this objective. When that's done, it's finished. The Russians have a great phrase. The ultimate compliment in the Russian language is to say that something будет стоит. To say
yes.
it будет стоит, it means it will last.
Будет стоит.
And if it will last, then that means it's good. If it won't last, then it's something that was not of great benefit. So that's a really helpful question, the будет стоит test on any given project. Will this project last without me when we're gone?
Будет стоит.
Yeah.
Test.
So it may be a one-time gift that will just be an encouragement to get them set up so that the thing can start going. But there are a lot of things that you can give towards. And again, we have endless supply. If you're looking for places to give, I can give you many, yeah. many projects that I think Buddhistai that will last, that will fit these criteria. There's an endless amount of projects where we can give towards the national church, but it's just choosing the right ones.
So John, if one of our listeners wants to get in touch with you, find out more about what you've worked on or written, or even just find out more about your ministries, what are some ways people can get involved in your ministry, whether that's supporting you, you are a missionary, you do get support, or even just get in touch with you and find out more about what you're doing.
Sure. My email address is jtaylor, J-T-A-Y-L-O-R at abwe.org. And you're welcome to contact me if you have any questions, if you'd like to follow up on any of the things that we've talked about, I'd be glad to share with you. And we work with a number of other projects. Our goal in the training and resources department here at ABWE is to equip our missionaries to serve with excellence. And so this is part of what we do. We're training our missionaries on the area of money because that has sidetracked many of our ministries. We're helping to prepare them to know how to give wisely, how to navigate the complexities of giving and missions. But we do many other things to train our missionaries, both in the area of evangelism and discipleship, church planning, missions movements, all of the things that we're working on together as a mission. But what we're finding that is we're preparing our missionaries and developing training and resources and programs that will assist them. These things actually work outside of ABWE as well. Amazingly, they work with national church. They work with that churches here in
like
North America.
Sounds like it's Buddhist Aid then.
Yeah, Buddhist Aid, hopefully. So even here in North America, many churches have taken advantage of some of these training and resources that we offer to our missionaries. But we find that they also work in North American context as well. And so we're open-handed as a mission, as you know, as ABWE. We want to give back to the church in North America and applying the principles that we're learning of money as a source of conflict to missionaries and nationals, just as we have been the recipient of so many resources from the church in North America. We as a mission, ABWE, want to give back to the churches. We would love to share some of our resources with you. In the area of evangelism discipleship, we have the Good Soil Evangelism Discipleship Ministry, and you can just go to our website. It's just type in Good Soil. It'll be at the top of the list. And you'll see dozens of resources there that we've developed that we would love to share with you to help you be more effective in reaching your communities with the gospel and discipling and making disciples.
Wonderful. John, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule today to join us and to talk us through this. And we look forward to reading the finished article in its published form and being able to get that in our hands and get that into the hands of more of our missionaries. So thank you again so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Alex. Thank you, Scott. God bless.
If you want to get more great content on theology, missions, and practice, go to missionspodcast.com. And while you're there, make sure that you subscribe in iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite listening platform. And please make sure that you also give us an honest review and a 5-star rating. And don't forget to be sending your questions to alex@missionspodcast.com, along with any other ideas for future episodes. And until next time, thank you for joining us.